Mike Pence uses the state surplus to pay back a federal government loan. What's the political benefit for the governor? Susan Brooks questions Hillary Clinton. The candidates for mayor of Indianapolis meet in a debate, and council candidates air TV ads. That plus a judge says ballot selfies are okay, $1 million potato chip recipe, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending October 23,
2015. Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, Governor Mike Pence announced a plan to pay back a federal loan. It means that employers in this state will no longer have to pay a penalty attached to their unemployment taxes. The state took out the loan to pay unemployment benefits during the recession. $250 million will be taken from the state budget surplus to pay it back. It means that employers will avoid a penalty of $126 per employee next year.
This action will continue Indiana's economic momentum, and it will take $327 million in new tax penalties off the table and off the books for small businesses and large businesses all across the state of Indiana.
Is that a tax cut? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican John Hammond, John Schwannis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Schella. And Delaney, was this a good move?
I actually think it was a good move because it avoids the penalties the federal government would have assessed otherwise. I just hope we learn from this, because the reason we got in this position in the first place was because we cut the taxes on employers earlier, and then obviously when the recession came, we didn't have enough money to pay the unemployment.
The loan got as big as $2 billion.
$2 billion. Now, it's going to be paid back, that 300 and some odd million dollars. It's going to be paid back with some interest, as I understand it. So employers aren't really getting a tax cut. They're avoiding an additional federal penalty. So I do think it's a good idea. I just hope that the governors learn from this. We don't get in this situation again.
Yeah, over this period, their unemployment taxes have actually gone up, as I understand it, but the penalties are being removed. So, and it wasn't Mike Pence's fault, this didn't happen on his watch, that this loan was taken out, yet he's calling it a tax cut. Can he get away with that?
Well, first of all, it is a good thing. I agree with Ann. I know we look for disagreement often on the show as part of our reason for existence here sometimes.
That's but Jim's reason.
That's Jim's reason for existence. But I do agree. It's actually a very good thing. Is it a tax cut? Well, there is $105 per employee was already being assessed. You can say that's a penalty or a tax. Certainly it's been levied on employers. It would have been another $126 dollars per employee
starting January 1st.
If this action had not been taken. So it is a reduction in cost to employers. It allows them, I tell you what, two important things. It would allow them to put the money back into their business in several different ways. Certainly, whether it's for raises for people or capital infrastructure. But the most important thing that I think it did, it removed the disincentive that has been there to hire one more person. Because every time you did that, you know you had an additional set of cost beyond just the salary, you had these other penalty costs as well.
To give you an idea of the effect on employers, there, Ann Sellers is an employer who was at the governor's announcement, says she has 70 employees in Indiana. It would cost her $10,000. Substantial sum.
It is substantial. Now, if you look at the employment base and the job creators and providers in Indiana, most of them are 10 or fewer employees, so the vast majority. So you could argue, I suppose, that the impact would have been incrementally smaller than it would have been on a 70-employee organization. But really, the fact of the matter is, it's good news. I mean, maybe this is a sign of the apocalypse because now everybody is in agreement. But it is, whether you call it a tax cut or not, it reduces the financial burden that would have been on those job creators, on small businesses, on large businesses. And that's, it makes the state whole. Now, there were a few years ago some people, as I recall, in the General Assembly who were saying, let's not pay it back. Let's gamble that the federal government would forgive this, which was sort of a surprise. In fact, it came from some people who normally would be taking a different tack. So good thing we didn't go that direction.
Well, most states borrowed money from the federal government during this time period, but we're down to just a handful of states who haven't paid it back. And some states did bonding in order to pay it back. And people looking at the circumstance in Indiana now say that they played it right because if you had bonded, the interest rate would be much higher. They waited until the amount was manageable and did it without extra cost to the state.
It was unfortunate that Indiana had to make this move to borrow those funds to begin with, as we discussed before. But the way the state has handled it, and certainly credit to Governor Pence for using that surplus, he had signaled in July to us that he was thinking about doing that, and as long as the reserves had held up, then this was something he wanted to do. I think it's a good use for the reserves because it does save the money for companies who have employees. That money can be used for other purposes. And you don't want to bond for these kinds of things. It's bad public policy, and so it was a good idea not to. So I think that this is the right thing. The one thing I hope comes out of this, and this was mentioned earlier, is that we don't find ourselves in that position again, that we keep a rate that's responsible, that's right, and that will cover unemployment increases next time there's a recession.
Well, and what's worth pointing out here is that the rate is such now that taxes are going to come in at a level where this can be paid back to the state surplus before the end of the fiscal year.
That's right. It all comes back in before the end of the fiscal year. Again, it's a lot of sound fiscal management for the last 10 years that has led to the opportunity, right, to have that reserve available to do this. And I think that's been a real plus.
That's right, to have the reserve available. The problem is it should be used for other things. It shouldn't have been used to make up for the cut that was done in the first place that caused the problem. I'm glad, I'm not faulting him for using the money now. What I'm saying is the cut initially caused this problem when this could have been used much more effectively for roads.
And that cut, all this started to happen. It's really not a partisan issue at all, but it all starts to happen in the early 2000s. We start paying out more than we're taking in, a whole variety of things. We hit a big recession in 2008, and all of a sudden we got to take the loan. So it's tough.
The only thing we know is there'll be another recession at some point.
That's right. But once the money gets paid back, that's the money that will be used for the governor's road plan announced last week.
We hope. And we hope that the governor will triple or quadruple the amount that he announced for roads last week.
Moving on.
He's making a good start, I'll say that.
So. Indiana Congresswoman Susan Brooks got the opportunity to question Hillary Clinton during a House committee investigation into the 2012 attack on the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi, Libya. She said to Clinton, quote, I can only conclude by your own records a lack of interest in Libya in 2012.
This pile represents the emails that you sent or received about Libya in 2011, from February through December of 2011. This pile represents the emails you sent or received from early 2012 until the day of the attack. There are 795 emails in this pile. We've counted them. There are 67 emails in this pile in 2012. And I'm troubled by what I see here.
John Hammond, is that a fair conclusion made by Susan Brooks?
Well, one thing I would say, I thought she did well in this exchange. She's a very smart, seasoned U.S. District Attorney, lawyer, prosecutor, and I think looking at some facts that are important to this particular witness. This is one witness, by the way, of 50. There have been seven.
Except they spent 11 hours.
That's right, 11 hours. But and to Hillary Clinton's credit, she answered every question. She cooperated with the panel. That was a very good thing, and I think the panel received it well. I know Susan Brooks thought that was a positive. I think that the conclusion there is, in 2011, when things were going well, there was a lot of activity between and among, while she was the Secretary of State and her staff, with the diplomatic embassy there. In 2012, when things weren't going so well, not so much. And why? And I know that
she says she communicated in other ways.
Had a chance to communicate in other ways, and that's for everybody to kind of discern and figure out. I think the committee's work, I think, has been very helpful and good because it's looked at some things. For instance, seven eyewitnesses that had never been questioned before have come before this committee. And the most important part of this, and that's why I want to take sort of the edge off of the partisan thing if I can for a second, there were four Americans that were killed, and it was right. A very tragic thing. And I think the focus on emails and other things that seem a little collateral, I think we've got to make sure that we're kind of looking at the big picture. And the big picture here is what was going on in 2012 when we didn't have as much exchange as we did in 2011.
Well, it was a good day for Hillary Clinton. Was it a good day for Susan Brooks?
No, it wasn't. I'm a supporter of Hillary Clinton. I have been for some time, and I thought she did an excellent job. I also had support of Susan Brooks before. Now, she has a terrific opponent now in Angela Demery, and so it's maybe a different ballgame this time around for her. But what really disappointed me about this is she had shown enough initiative in the past. She went against the party on domestic violence issues. She didn't want to shut the government down. Now she's gone Washington. She was part of that debacle, that performance art that was on there, wasting $20 million of tax money trying to derail Hillary Clinton's campaign. They asked the chairman at the end of this, 11 hours of testimony, what new that he learned? Answer, nothing. It is obvious that McCarthy was right when he said this was done exactly to derail her campaign, and I am shocked and disappointed that Susan Brooks would lend her gender and expertise to that endeavor. Well,
Congressman Kevin McCarthy, you're referencing, the argument here is that this was all political. Susan Brooks beforehand said that's not the case. What's it look like at this point?
Well, I think the interesting observation for me about this is that in the aftermath of that, the people who were against Hillary Clinton or pro the committee remain even more so, and the people who were on Hillary Clinton's side in anti-committee remain even more so now. The vast majority of us in the middle look at this and say, what's the point? And when you have, this is now the eighth time this committee has been convened for this purpose, when you consider all of the other important things that have happened in the past, all of the big scandals that have occurred from Watergate forward, this is four times the number of hearings that we had for something like Watergate. And so I think most of us think in the middle are thinking, what is going on here?
That's not quite right. And you're measuring it on the wrong basis for the Watergate proceedings. The Congress has had a long, long history of doing investigatory hearings. And again, I'm going to reiterate, what's shocking to me is that four Americans, one of whom was the ambassador to Libya, was left unprotected in a very dangerous situation. Yeah. And what happened? I think it's fully within the realm of the Congress, no matter who controls it, to look into that question. And I think that's what...
They've been looking into it at five and six and seven times the rate of every other catastrophe where Americans were killed. And I think that Congressman Cummings made the best point. That $20 million could have gone a long way to bolstering security at embassies around the world.
Is the public paying attention to this, or is it just political insiders?
Well, the political insiders are paying attention to it, and they've made it a cottage industry. I think as it relates to the general public, I think that may be where Bernie Sanders was right at the Democratic presidential debate a week or so back when he got the round of applause by saying that the American public doesn't care about Hillary Clinton's emails. There's a saturation point probably, and when it Representative McCarthy didn't do himself any favors by suggesting that it was political, that certainly blunted.
Might have cost him the speakership.
Well, probably did, and it certainly blunted the impact on Hillary Clinton. But having said that, I differ a little bit. I don't see Susan Brooks' questioning as being anything untoward. I mean, there's a legitimate question there.
She behaved well with her demeanor. It's greasy kid stuff. The number of emails doesn't tell you anything.
It is a piece of evidence.
They're asking
the question, where was all the activity when it was most needed?
It did, It did.
I thought it was about.
It was never adequately answered. It did earn her attention.
The
Secretary of State, the witness,
media,
never answered that question.
New York Times, Washington Post, which made a big deal about, you know, the gender battle here that you alluded to, lending her gender. I'm not suggesting, though, that she did it for that purpose. But
no, she wants to be in leadership. Right. That's clear.
Well, she did a
moving
great job.
Moving on. Since we were here last, the candidates for mayor of Indianapolis took part in their only formal televised debate. Democrat Joe Hogsett and Republican Chuck Brewer answered my questions for a half hour in a relatively tame affair. Here's the closing pitch from Hogsett, followed by Brewer.
There is nothing that I will stop from doing to protect all 10-year-olds, your children, my children, making Indianapolis a safe and prosperous place and our neighborhoods peaceful and prosperous.
I've got no experience in politics, but I am a very strong leader and I'm a savvy businessman. And I will make sure that the finances in this city are turned around and headed in the right direction.
John Katzenberger, did Chuck Brewer miss an opportunity there?
Well, he certainly didn't take the opportunity to attack Joe Hogsett, if that's what you're talking about, and to go after his record. He was at behind the eight ball the entire time. When you have 30 minutes and you've got a rapid-fire format, it's very difficult for him to be able to lay out the case for him and at the same time take shots at his opponent. So he was in a very difficult situation to start with.
But here's an interesting fact for you. We did a coin flip to see who goes first, and Chuck Brewer won the coin flip, and he chose to go second.
Yes.
That's not what you want to do if you're an underdog and you need to force the issue, is it?
Well, if the conventional wisdom is you need to attack. But the challenge that he would have faced, it seems to me, and what maybe kept him from taking that approach is that the sort of odd reality maybe that these guys actually agree on most everything. And they really, in many ways, they're both, you know, there's no joke candidate here, no strident candidate. You have two very serious right. people who care seemingly about urban affairs and public policy and ways to address some of the problems facing the city. And they do agree. So for him to come out and attack probably, I'm not sure, really would have gotten him anywhere. This really came down to who's the bigger Boy Scout. Here's the Marine. Here's the person who helps ladies across the street. Here's the one who, you know, pets the dogs. I mean, that's really what this kind of comes down to.
Okay, so aside from the debate, the TV ads are where these races are really won and lost. And we all know that if you're going to behind and you want to catch up, you need to go on the attack. Chuck Brewer's got a new ad out. It's an endorsement ad from the mayor. Is that, in effect, Chuck Brewer waving the white flag at this point?
No, but, you know, Chuck Brewer is a very serious, thoughtful person. And John Schwanis just described him that way, as well as Joe Hogsett. But he is not a traditional politician. He is trying to run this campaign the way he'd like to have it run, which is on a positive level. He wants to continue the legacy of the Ballard administration. That's obviously the purpose of those commercials. No, he's not waving the white flag. I think they've still got a little bit of gas in the tank. You'll see possibly some things between now and the next 10 days that pass by. But outside of that, I mean, this is the person we have. I would be very proud. I'm, you know, obviously a Republican, mm-hmm. National Committeeman from Marion County. He'd make a great mayor, Chuck Brewer would. And the question is, can he get elected? And that's what he's striving to do. He's running against somebody who's had a record in office, who's been there a long time. He's a more traditional politician, his opponent. Chuck Brewer is not. The people have to make a decision which one they want.
Is it over?
Yes. And the fact that you had one half-hour debate on a Friday night is a pretty good indicator that it's over. He has an insurmountable lead, and Chuck Brewer may be a very nice man, and I'm sure he'll serve the city well in some other capacity.
How many debates, and I'm honestly asking this, not knowing the answer, but how many?
There will be a radio
debate. Are we going to have?
There will be a radio debate, and there will be another joint appearance on television.
Joint appearance?
Yeah, this is similar to what incumbents have agreed to in past campaigns.
So, right, and so has Brewer made requests, and vice versa?
Yes.
Has Hogsett made requests? Who's made
Brewer has made requests. Hogsett has controlled the negotiations.
Okay, so he's decided to limit the numbers.
Right.
Brewer wanted, nine, I think, was the number he threw out, which clearly would not
And the fact that there's one tells you.
Yeah. All right. For the first time, TV ads are being used in a district race for the Indianapolis City County Council. It's the race between Democrat Kip Tu and Republican Colleen Fanning. Kip Tu is the incumbent and a longtime Democratic operative who once served as state party chairman. Colleen Fanning is a business owner and first-time candidate. She's the one who began airing TV ads on cable channels this week, and Tu now promises to follow suit. The race is in District 2, which includes several Northside neighborhoods and Broad Ripple Village. Both candidates say they need to concentrate on district issues. Here's Tu, followed by Fanning.
We have a very difficult crime problem in the city, and it's reached our district. Just the other day, we had a couple people mugged on the Monon up near Nora, and we got to have more police officers on the street.
Public safety, obviously, is always the elephant in any room with 90% of the city's budget, so that's always huge.
John Schwanes, TV ads for an opportunity to represent 1/25th of the city. How crazy is that?
Boy, I hadn't done the math on it, Jim. Maybe I have to change my
25 seats on the city county council. They're all divided equally.
True, but I mean, this is in some ways, and I don't want to say that the mayoral contest necessarily is over, but it's for all practical purposes. This is the battleground.
This tells you that the Republicans are concentrating on.
This tells
of the
me that there certainly there's a desire right now. Of course, Democrats hold a one seat advantage now at large. There's a lot of we could get bogged down in the mechanics of districts and district representation, but the fact of the matter is, Republicans would love to gain control of the council to have some sense of checks and balances here.
Will they?
I think it's really a toss-up. With 25 mm-hmm. district seats and no at-large this time, they're going to need the Democrats are going to need Joe Hogsett to poll really well and bring a lot of people in each of these districts in order to win. I think it's a real toss-up.
So does Joe Hogsett start concentrating on the council at this point?
Well, I think he should, because I think John's right. I mean, the ballots are going to be pretty darn simple. You have mayor and city council, two people on
right,
the ballot.
Right. It may come down to this race between Fanning and Tu.
Maybe one or two others,
but I think the Democrats have a preponderance and certainly going to win 10. Republicans are going to win 9. There are 6 at stake.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, what's better, A, one-party control, B, divided government, or C, it shouldn't matter? Last week's question, will infrastructure still be a big issue in the race for governor? 74% said yes, 11% said no, 15% said only if another bridge fails before Election Day. Now, if you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Federal Judge Sarah Evans Barker issued a preliminary injunction this week. It means that it's now okay to take a ballot selfie during the November election. The ruling blocks a new state law that makes the taking of a ballot selfie a felony. A ballot selfie would be a photo of you and your ballot taken in the polling place using a cell phone. The law took effect July 1st and was challenged by the ACLU. In her ruling, Judge Barker wrote that the new law is, quote, a restriction on speech that cannot survive strict scrutiny. John Hammond, will that law die a quiet death?
Well, it's still, I don't know. It's been on the books in some form about photographing a ballot since 1945. I think most of us here may have known that, but I actually did not know that. And so there was no change in the penalty for such a violation, et cetera. So here it is. That could survive, I suppose, if they find more and more instances where some of this has happened and it potentially relates to vote buying, then I know you're trying to get on to the next thing, but if they find that, then they may come back and be able to challenge the judge's ruling.
It's another law in search of a problem. You can't. The reason the other ones were on the books was to protect the voters. If the voter wants to go out there and broadcast to the world how he or she votes, that's her business or his business.
Yeah, and I don't take a lot of umbrage.
I think that these
decision.
Are, again, right. part of the restrictions Republicans keep putting in to make it as difficult as possible to vote.
Finally, a Noblesville woman is $1 million richer thanks to her grandmother's cooking. Haley Green was named a finalist in this summer's flavor contest conducted by Lay's Potato Chips. Her recipe was for Southern biscuits and gravy flavored chips. Here's how she got the idea.
The contest was going on last year, and I was having biscuits and gravy at my grandma and grandpa's house, and she had made breakfast potatoes as well. And I was like, oh, that Lay's contest. This might be good as a potato chip. So Lay's thought so too, and so did America.
So did America. And Delaney, why didn't you think of that?
Because I don't eat biscuits and gravy. Sorry. I mean, more power to her for inventing it. I doubt if it'll be on anybody's list for foods that ought to be eaten for a healthy diet.
The qualification is, if you've eaten them, you should come up with the idea. I should have come up with the idea. Because I have, as my midsection suggests, I've eaten more than my
more
share
than
of biscuits.
She won
$1 million, but if they sell more than $100 million worth in a year, she'll get a percentage of the 1%, I think, of the overage. You think she'll make more money?
When the chips are down, the gravy is tasty. Okay,
oh,
so
nice.
She is $1 million idea has come to fruition. So
that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican John Hammond, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.